inadequate to keep pace with inflation and rising living costs. So again, let me repeat that. What this contract currently does, and this is what a lot of people are seeing, because even again, we're still not seeing the full contract, but what's being reported by the strikers right now is that the contract maintains the multi-tier wage and benefit structure that has basically destroyed the power of the auto workers, the rank and file workers. So that's still in the contract. The second thing it does is it sanctions the closure of four different facilities, including Lordstown Assembly and Baltimore and the Warren Transmission. It also includes just 2-3% wage increases over the life of the contract, which is completely inadequate to what's happening right now under this new recession with rising inflation and, of course, rising living costs. So that right now is what's in the contract now. So it looks like the only gain, which most of us would not call a gain, but on paper is a gain, but it will be erased, is the 2-3% raises across the life of the contract. That's what the United Auto Workers negotiating team is pushing for the rank and file workers to ratify. Workers on the picket line at Warren Tech in Warren, Michigan, reacted with skepticism in the effort of the UAW to present the agreement as a major victory. One worker was reported as saying, quote, "Until the contract is read and ratified by the membership, we should not go back inside the plant," end quote. Another worker wrote in the Auto Worker newsletter, which is a good newsletter, by the way, quote, "I've done a few polls of other workers and don't believe that support is behind it. 3 years consecutively for temps to be hired as regular employees means they can be laid off for 32 days every 2.5 years and never be hired full time."
Oh, wow.
"Even if GM did not intend this, this auto industry is too fickle."
You know, there are so many companies that have been doing that for, quite some time. And for example, what used to be J.M. Jones, what is that now?
I don't remember.
Yeah, okay, anyway, it's got a pretty sordid history anyway.
Yeah.
But I went out there and applied for a job once, even got an interview. You know what I should have done? Went to a temp agency.
Oh, yeah.
That's how people really, why didn't they tell me that?
Yeah.
Why did they have me come in for an interview and not, and why didn't they just tell me to go to the temp agency?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was saying sordid history with this company because they completely wiped out their transportation. Here's how ruthless this company was. They completely wiped out their transportation department, fired everybody mm-hmm. to keep the Teamsters out.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And then made them quote unquote independent contractors.
Right, made drivers independent. But remember our friends like Mike Lehman? Well, he didn't have an opportunity to buy a truck because he worked in their transportation department office.
Uh huh.
You know, and they didn't have anything for him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he went and got a PhD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was. I found that surprising when I was reading in the corporate media about this, agreement about how it was the temp workers' time that they were going to be temp workers was reduced so significantly. But now I see the loophole.
Yeah. So the lower tier workers are told that they'll wait 4 years to get max pay because 8 years was unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
The union then happened to be the ones who offered a contract that left most of them still waiting for 8 years. And they don't get the two bonuses, right? So that's what the contract is shaping up. And a lot of workers are frustrated and they're talking about it a lot right now. An auto worker with decades at GM Wentzville Assembly in St. Louis, Missouri said, quote, "Most older employees say we are screwed. Everyone agrees with what the auto worker newsletter was saying. They sold us out again and sent us that bull as if they were really working out a great deal," end quote.
Man, I tell you, it was, I mean, even with just the first two-tier program they had, if I hired on at the lower tier, I'd be saying, what am I paying union dues for?
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
You know, I'm kind of saying that today, right now. You know why?
Yeah.
because we don't have seniority in the laborers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just got laid off for a younger and prettier laborer.
Oh, prettier, huh? Well, okay.
Yeah. No, I'm serious, man. Go on with your story. I'll tell you this.
No, that's...
No, we'll talk about this. I want to tell the story, man. It's just how things are. And one of the reasons I'm really glad to be getting out of the building trades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got two stories on that.
Yeah. Grievance? What's that?
I know, right? Yeah.
Seniority? What's that?
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what GM was hoping for.
And see, usually it's customary not to lay off your longer standing employees. Mm-hmm. But,
It used to be. But that's been the strategy since the 70s, though.
The guy who laid me off, I went to grade school with his dad, and we were friends, and our families were friends.
Oh, boy.
That's how it is now. Yeah, a Ford worker from Michigan said this in regard to the contract. Quote: "In regard to the contract, nobody knows anything about it. My experience is that that they only give highlights. We're going to lose health care, wages, and everything else we fought for. With 18 months of negotiations, they are against us." End quote. John, who was a Fiat Chrysler worker, said, quote, "GM workers should have gotten more in this contract for as hard as we work in these plants. It's a capitalist country, and it's all about taking money off of the poor man. Yes, the UAW is supposed to represent the workers, but instead they are stealing from the workers. I agree with forming rank-and-file committees instead of getting these pencil pushers. Let the people themselves vote and decide. Wall Street runs this country. We got to change that," end quote. So even in the rank and file, you have these ideas of revolution and socialist understandings of what's going on in this country. So for all these people that think blue collar workers are just a bunch of drones who just go to work and they just and they vote for Trump and they do all this other stuff. No, these what's happening right now with this strike is showing that there is a class consciousness that's still there. It's not fully developed because of years of being broken apart by neoliberal agenda, but there's still a class consciousness amongst the working class that is starting to emerge both in the U.S. and internationally.
Yes.
If this TA is ratified either through the workers or pushed through by the corrupt leadership, the best thing we can say coming out of this is that the workers are starting to have more consciousness from this event and that something much stronger is coming down the road from it based on what they're saying about this contract. The workers are not simply what the corporate media portrays them as.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's still something there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Despite all the corporate media propaganda on a daily basis, not just, misreporting the news, but the entire narrative of reality,
Exactly.
That's the other thing that's about the corporate media. But this is what's interesting. I was, kind of in relation to this. I remember when was that 3 weeks ago when we had that one auto worker call in from Michigan. I was really pleasantly surprised about him throwing out some labor history and stuff. So obviously these workers are saying, why is this happening? What's going on here? Let's look, and some of them are going back and looking at the historical record,
Yeah, the idea of exploitation now is becoming a more mainstream thing. That, again, you all are better, could be better judges on this than I was, because in the 80s and 90s, I was a little kid. I didn't understand what was going on. But from my understandings, exploitation was not as common because of what had happened with the neoliberal push. Mm-hmm. And a lot of stuff after the 90s. You had some of that with the UPS strike, but outside of that, there was no general sense like we're seeing now that there is a legitimate issue, not just with the corporate structure, but also with what the so-called leadership of our protest movements is doing, not just outside of police brutality stuff, what we saw with the issues of Black Lives Matter, but when we're looking at the union movements beginning with West Virginia last year, and what happened with the AFT trying to break their strike. Mm-hmm. And then we're seeing all these other instances, UAW now over a month-long strike, and the UAW is pushing a concession contract now, and the workers are responding to it in a more rebellious way. You heard what the worker I just quoted said. We need rank and file committees. This is something we've been talking about on this show forever, is that even the workers are saying an internal rebellion is possible.
Yeah. Yes, this is. I see. That's where this is heading. I mean, wildcat strikes. You know, hopefully maybe occupations. Because you know, let's face it. I mean, you know, when you go out on strike and you leave the workplace, I mean, you're kind of a bit of a disadvantage. You occupy that workplace. Oh man, you've got total control, and that's the reason why the labor struggles in the 1930s were so successful, because they relied on mainly occupations.
Yeah, the sit down strikes. Yeah,
you got a problem though.
What's that?
Parking lots.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Big thank you. Lots. Good point. Yes, good point. That's what
I mean. I would think that might be one of the reasons places are surrounded by parking lots
and big 8-foot fences with you know, barbed wire.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. But again, though, and that's the thing. When you leave the place, they can replace you. They can lock you out. They can do all these things when you leave the actual moat, the actual means of production. When you leave it, the owners can do whatever they want with it. They can move it. They can close it and take it somewhere else.
Bring in scabs.
Scab it. They can do all these things to it. But when you actually occupy and sit down in the – that's when the New Deal stuff came along. That's everybody keeps – that's when the capitalists really took the workers seriously. There were so many sit-down strikes in the 30s.
They were really affecting their capital.
Exactly. They were closing the means of production down, and they were not going to open them. They were actually having dinner and sleeping there day and night. The neighborhood people were involved bringing food, bringing supplies. The famous Minneapolis one where they tried to overheat and smoke out the workers, and the neighborhood kids and women came and threw the rocks through the windows
to air everything out. Lots. Yeah. Now you can't get to the windows. You can't supply the people. You have, you know, you really probably have to organize this very secretly, and people come with incredibly well-stocked lunch boxes. Make sure you do it the day after the vending machines are filled.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, those fences, they can be cut through with bolt cutters. Huge holes open in the fence all over the place, like Swiss cheese.
Okay, but that's what I'm looking at there. I'm kind of digging that, because that's kind of insurrection level.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Action.
But you hear a lot of the stuff that the workers are saying now, especially here's the thing that we got to take from this as well. The workers have just quit their jobs for over a month. Right? This is a work stoppage for over a month, and that's the contract they're getting back. That type of reaction usually leads to insurrectionist thoughts and rebellious feelings about being exploited by not only the company, but my union negotiating leadership, what the worker here called pencil pushers. So there's something brewing that, you can see some fences getting cut very soon. Especially, I'm really going to be watching the news, not the CNN garbage, but I'm really going to be watching the worker news and alternative media to see where this vote goes.
Yes.
Because I'm telling you, this could be a huge determinant of what's going to happen with auto workers over the next decade, the way this vote goes. Because if they vote no and this thing still gets pushed through, you could see an internal rebellion. You could see an insurrection amongst rank and file workers.
Yeah, I mean, I am just amazed. I shouldn't be, but I'm really amazed the difference between the report you just gave and what I saw just yesterday reported in the corporate media. They made it sound like that they got a great contract, you know?
Oh, yeah, because, again, what they probably said was they're getting two raises over the span of the contract. And, again, if you're an everyday person that doesn't follow or know what a contract is or know what it's supposed to be, which most people don't unless you work in that field or you're, you know, you specialize in union labor, you're going to think, the workers, they struck for a month and they were able to get two raises now. This is amazing. They're set for life.
Yeah, plus cutting in half the amount of time that the lower tier workers have to spend in those lower tiers.
Exactly.
Not mentioning this whole thing about the layoff and 2.5 years and disrupting that seniority pattern.
Exactly. But if you were following, you know the number one thing they wanted to get rid of was the multi-tier wage structure from the get-go, and it's still in the contract, then that's a failed strike.
That's right.
Because when you go out on strike, you have one or two things you go out on strike on, and you do not end the strike unless the members decide that they can no longer get those two things, right? And the thing that they went out on strike for was to end the multi-tier wage structure. That's the number one thing. Anything else that's put into the contract are extras. For us, for our strike, our two things we went out for were tuition waivers and raises. Anything else that we got in our contract, because our strike was so strong, we just added in there because we just had the university beaten on their knees.
Yeah.
So we just added stuff.
So in other words, there were two basic demands that you refused to back down on.
That was it.
It's like, nope, we're not compromising on these. We're going to keep fighting until we get
that's
it.
That's why you quit your job. You're like, I'm going to the extreme. The number one thing that I have, my power, I'm going to quit on is that these are the things that I cannot concede on.
Yeah.
And yet when you concede and you leave a multi-tier wage structure in there, that means two things. Number one, the strike was weak.
Yep.
Or number two, you got co-opted.
Sold out.
Yeah, you got sold out. So that's one of the two options that happened here.
Yep. Yeah.
And the workers know it.
And there goes solidarity.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like,
and here comes decertification.
Yep.
Possibly. When those older top-tier workers are gone.
Yep.
You know, what's the other three or four tiers going to do?
That's right.
You know?
Yep. Not to mention this huge criminal probe that's still going on.
Yep.
We're not even talking about that. There have already been two indictments, and there are more that are probably coming. So
which is kind of almost a little odd, because usually what happens is there's a consent decree signed with the Justice Department, and there's internal trials and...
Oh, interesting observation, Bill.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean,
they're just kind of hanging this, you know, like waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Have you ever heard of Arthur Coya?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Arthur Coya, it was really funny. Somebody sent me an email about him with the subject heading.
He was a national president of the Laborers Union for a while. Right.
What color is your Ferrari? And
he had how many Ferraris?
I can't remember. But anyway, he was buying a Ferrari. He bought a Ferrari from a dealership that does business with the union.
Okay.
And say the Laborers International Union, man, that's some big business.
Uh-huh.
They're buying a lot of cars and trucks.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm helping to pay for, I think, three trucks right now the local level. So you can imagine the international level.
Yeah.
Well, what this dealer did was went ahead and gave him, like, possession of the car,
mm-hmm.
but kept the title.
Okay.
So that Coya could avoid what was the tax? It was like tens of thousands of dollars in tax on this car.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is like it's a top of the line Ferrari. And that's what he was really busted on.
Ah, okay.
You see, like Al Capone,
tax evasion
scam.
Okay.
And what happened was they signed a consent decree with the Justice Department. He was taken out of his presidency, but given the title President Emeritus,
mm-hmm.
keeping paid his salary.
Wow.
Yes, that's how he was punished.
Wow.
You know?
Mm-mm. Yeah.
So, that's what looks really, you know.
Kind of a little suspicious.
Exactly.
Yeah, with this particular action against the United Auto Workers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
You see,
that's a very good point, Bill. Wow.
Yeah, see, usually... You see, what the idea was they didn't want to alienate, you know, the workers, and also they didn't want it to look like that they were suppressing unions. See, that's how far we have gone now in 20 years, mm-hmm. where they're not afraid to come in and indict people,
mm-hmm.
and arrest them and search their houses.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying they should have been doing it all along.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting about the factory occupations. One thing that our silent partner just passed me a note about, he said, as far as getting food to the occupying workers, the use of drones.
Yeah, there you go. I never thought about that, man.
Yeah.
And I'm a photographer. I'm listening to podcasts about people shooting with drones all the time.
Well, that's probably what the cops will do. They'll try to shoot the drones down as they go in. But, man, that'd be quite interesting. But anyway.
That'd be really interesting, too, because, you know, when you shoot your gun as a cop, you have to report every time you shoot.
Oh, okay.
You got to file a report for every bullet that's fired from your weapon. And so, like, you get a bunch of reports coming in, and then media gets hold that, no, these cops are shooting down food for starving people. Yeah. How that would play in the public press for people who already don't think that the police were removed from the working class
brilliant.
Already.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let them shoot down food for workers.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. You listen to the World Labor on the supported community radio station, WRFU Radio Free Urbana. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
look in the mirror. Tell me what you see. Another satisfied customer in the front of the line for the American dream. Now I remember we was both out on the boulevard talking revolution, man, singing the blues. But nowadays it's letters to the editor, and cheating on the taxes is the best that we can do. Come on. Shopping in the scalpels, trying to cut a deal. Meanwhile, back at the hospital, got accounts playing, got me passing out the pills. Yeah, I know that sucks that your HMO ain't doing what you thought it would do, but everybody's gotta die sometime, and we can't save everybody. It's the best that we can do.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to The World Labor on the supported community radio station, WRFU Radio Free Urbana. And Gus, I guess there's quite a bit going on in Chicago started this week, right?
I think that's an understatement. 32,000 people would beg to differ, say that this is a reshaping of the city. Oh, hopefully.
Yes, yes.
And it's the reasons why are important. This isn't simply a regular strike, because the lines have been drawn so clearly for the sides that there's really only one way out of this thing. The reason why I contextualize it that way is because the neoliberal mayor Lightfoot, who we've mentioned on the show back when she won the mayorship, has pretty much followed in Rahm Emanuel's footsteps.
Yeah, we predicted that.
Yeah.
Especially you.
Yeah.
Know.
Yeah. You know, but
you
again,
didn't give her any slack.
Again, because it's a black woman, so everybody's supposed to think that, you know, this is a profound movement forward, because, you know, liberals especially are obsessed with symbolic representation versus actual tangible results and ideology. Mm-hmm. So seeing a black woman who clearly had a neoliberal agenda running for mayor, well, it's some progress. Well, here we are now, The city continues to be in one of the worst housing crises in U.S. history. I would argue world history, but I don't have the data to back that up.
Okay.
But definitely U.S. history. The schooling situation after the closure of 49 schools since the last CTU strike of 2012. Now we have an overcrowded and underfunding school system.
Public school system. Yeah, the charter schools, though, that the public's funding with
I got a whole nother story for that.
That's why those 49 schools were closed.
Exactly. That everything's tying together.
Yeah.
And that this is a racial class struggle that has preempted a lot of the problems that people consider to be violence in the city. And here we are right now at a moment where the entire country should be supporting these strikers, because all you hear from the liberals and the corporate media in general is just how terrible Chicago is as a city. It's so violent. There's so many deaths happening. Why can't they fix the city? Trump threatened to send troops into the city. All these people are using all this racially pathological racist garbage to talk about how bad the city is because it's a majority black city. Yet here we are, where you have an organized movement to improve the conditions of the city. And yet, where's the support at outside of the usual groups? Like, this is what all these corporate media folks and all these liberal groups are just so dismayed at how nasty Chicago is. And yet, why aren't they picketing? Why aren't they finding a way to get Chicago? Because what the Chicago teachers and the workers, the staff members who are SEIU affiliate, what they put on the table is to actually revamp the entire school structure, so that you don't have closures of schools, that you have resources and support for many of these schools where 99% of the children are poverty stricken. Now, mind you, that means that they are federally identified as being in poverty. So the ones who fall right below that threshold who were not poverty stricken, that's the other group, that's the other thousands of students as well. They just don't meet that threshold. So again, you're having a moment here where you can actually improve the resources of the poverty stricken people that lead to a lot of the problems in the city, the class struggles in the city. And yet there's very little of support coming from these liberal and petty bourgeois groups. And it's incredibly infuriating because it's allowed the city to maintain some leverage that I'll get into in a second.
Well, I was just thinking too, you know, you're talking poverty stricken students come to school at such a disadvantage, you know, I mean, just nutritionally.
Yeah, exactly.
If anything, you know.
That's one of the biggest.
Read Jonathan Sokol.
Yeah. That's one of the biggest issues that the teachers have stated repeatedly, is that why are you still charging for lunches knowing that these kids, this is the only nutritional meal that many of them get every day. That's it. And they don't have textbooks. Many of them don't have clothes to wear to school. But, of course, the liberal, the corporate media, every time you see media, they show some ridiculous foolishness of the people who are in the middle class buying shoes or buying clothes and stuff and say, well, look at these black kids. They're buying all these clothes and stuff. Their parents are spending money on cell phones. That's not the real reality of Chicago, because the people who put that crap on the TV and in newspapers have never actually been in the working class and poor neighborhoods of Chicago and seen it. I've seen it in my city, because most of my students I taught in Atlanta only had one or two pairs of clothing when they came to school. And that's the reality of it.
Well, there's another thing, too, that a lot of people don't realize. They'll be like, you know, maybe somebody will buy those shoes or the phone or the clothes, okay? And people be like, oh, well, why aren't they saving up to buy a house?
Exactly. Huh.
Because they'll never be able to save up to buy a house.
Exactly.
But occasionally they can buy a nice pair of shoes.
Exactly.
And oh, you know? Lord, I mean, that's God. Something so bad.
You but you see what I'm saying, though?
Yeah, that's absolutely.
That's how the media does it, though. The media fractures movements along ideological lines because they put that garbage up there. And they force you to think, well, there has to be something different about them than those others, right?
Yeah.
So they otherize.
Well, aren't they pulling themselves up by their bootstraps just like the Irish did?
Exactly. So
because let me see.
Yeah, because and no surprise that there are people who are there that are texting me from the picket lines and saying, yeah, that's what they're saying to us. They're calling us greedy. They're calling us lazy on the picket line. People are walking by and calling them these things.
Yes, I actually heard a Facebook friend of mine who lives in Chicago was at that big march in downtown Chicago, and when they went past the Chicago Board of Trade, they got thousands of leaflets dumped on them from the windows, which said, you don't work hard enough to deserve more money.
Exactly.
I mean, they obviously had to plan that. They knew that the route was coming. I mean, they went to that kind of effort, you know.
Man, that's disgusting. And, you know, this isn't just teachers.
It's staff, too, yeah.
Well, there's if anybody wants to hear a whole bunch about this and spend a lot of time listening to it, go to radioforall.net. And I just searched the word Chicago and came up with the second item is Chicago Teachers Union Strike Solidarity Rally. And this thing is real long and it has several speakers. And it's like the Park District and some other city employees.
Oh, yeah.
And they're talking about just how bad things are for, like, all of these employees and all these people, like special education assistants, are doing all kinds of stuff they're not supposed to do, and they're barely getting by. Teachers' assistants, it's incredibly low wages.
Yeah.
Park District people, you top out at $40,000 a year.
Yeah.
You know what, in Chicago?
Yeah, yeah.
That's topping out.
Exactly.
Now, this strike, it's not just about, you know, the teachers, salaries and healthcare costs, but also a big central issue about this is the cost of living, the housing in Chicago.
Yes.
And the teachers aren't just doing it for themselves. They're also talking about that they want to expand this for everybody in the city of Chicago that's poor and working class to have affordable housing.
Yes.
Which I think this is the first time this has happened since, late 1940s.
It's not pure and simple unionism.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's why I said earlier at the beginning that the lines have been drawn in the sand for this to revamp the city of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the teachers put on hold. They said, listen, we got something here. We have to, because nobody can afford to live here anymore. The row houses are being set up. Homelessness is on the rise. Nobody can live a life, not just a comfortable life anymore, but nobody can live a life in this city anymore. And this is literally down the line, not just from the teachers, the staff members, the clerical workers, and as Bill mentioned, the city workers. Because Chicago has had multiple strikes going back to 2018 from multiple different groups about the same issues, right?
Oh,
transit workers.
Transit workers too. Yeah. Auto workers.
Yep.
Now, one of the speakers at this solidarity rally pointed out that some administrators are getting up to 20% raises in the coming years.
Oh, yeah, of course they are. Yeah, that's what they do. The administrators, that they get the raises. And again, that's why and people get upset at me because I group all the administration and human resources group as being just the worst human beings ever. But when you hear these kinds of stories and when you read what happened at the end of the 2008 recession with the bailouts and the money that a lot of these CEOs and middle managers got, then how can you not consider these people to be the enemy of the people? And this same thing is happening in Chicago. And again, for the people that think we're being too scary and all this other stuff, go to Southside Chicago. Spend a day in the Southside Chicago. Go into an elementary school in Southside Chicago and tell me that we're going to Baltimore City Schools, going to Atlanta Public Schools, and tell us that we're being too scary. Like, this is it is disgusting how these people are being treated by the governments. And of course, here's where the lines are being drawn at going back into the city. Here's the scary thing for me in relation to what CTU is doing. Now, the teachers had laid it out there. This is what we want, right? The city came back yesterday after the second day of picketing saying that we have made a lot of progress, right? But the city stands from the beginning that the strike was threatened. Lightfoot said there is no money, right? That's Lightfoot.
No money for you.
We've been hearing that since 1980.
Now, here's my thing, though. Now, here's what's scary to me about that. Whenever that has happened, Whenever the city or any entity has publicly came out and said there is no money, right? What usually ends up happening during a negotiation?
Not sure.
Concessions.
Yeah.
Because the city has already laid their big I impasse reasoning out there. So the strike cannot be short term at this point. The workers have to recognize that, and CTU has to recognize that they cannot BS this strike. Mm-hmm. Because if the city says there's no money, the only way the city is going to go back and get the revenue money and redistribute it for the workers is going to be a complete shutdown of the city of Chicago for an extended period of time. I'm talking at least 2 months, possibly.
Yeah.
That's how long this has to go. So, that's important to recognize now, because, again, when you're in the negotiating room, when you get to big I impasse, for those listening, that means that there is no legitimate, at this time, way that we're going to concede to your thing.
Yeah.
And that's because we're not going to, that it would cause them having to rebalance their revenue books to put the money in the contract for the workers. And let's be honest, the neoliberals, the petty bourgeoisie, these reformist city governors, city governments, mayors, etc., they're lazy. That's a lot of bookkeeping, a lot of money processing you have to do. And they're not going to, they don't think that workers are worth the effort to do that. That's why you're going to have to destroy city operations for at least 2 months for them to say, if we don't get the city back up and running again, we're finished.
Yeah.
That's the only way this thing, what the teachers want, is going to go through. And I personally, because of what happened with CTU and Rahm Emanuel, I'm worried that CTU leadership may not be willing to go that far.
Mm-hmm.
That's what worries me.
Yeah, and you know from personal experience as a contract negotiator
in
the past as GEO, that they always say to one extent or another that they don't have any money, and it's a job of a good negotiating team to go do the research and find out just where and what money they have.
But here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that Chicago is broke budget-wise.
Yeah.
But nobody knows where Chicago's revenue streams are currently being distributed. That's the issue. Because because you know how we always say the state of Illinois does not have a budget problem. It has a revenue problem.
Yeah.
And it's always had that. The same goes for the city of Chicago. So the negotiating team, yeah, they can do the research, but the city Lightfoot can always say, we don't have any money. Those numbers, I don't know where those numbers came from. We don't have plausible deniability. That's what the CIA operated off of for so many years.
Yeah.
The neoliberals passed that on. So the workers are the ones that are going to have to push the bargaining room by shutting city operations down. And I'm worried because CTU does have some partnership with the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And with Lightfoot getting elected.
Mm-hmm.
That they may be willing to not go that far into making her into the scapegoat for the largest and most devastating strike in Chicago history.
Oh, man, that last, what you just said there at the end. That's right. I forgot CTU backed Lightfoot.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, boy.
So that's what we have to understand, why this is so complex. This thing is so complicated at this point. So the leadership is going to have to really dig deep and say, we're either in, all in, or we need to go ahead and just sign the concession now, because they're not going to give us anything else if we don't destroy city operations for 2 months at least. Mm-hmm. I was always told this before we went on strike by really good people. What do you have leverage-wise that's going to make the other side beg you to come back to the table when you're out on strike? Because that's what has to happen. Because when you're out on strike, the first week, they're upset at you. They don't want to talk to you and go and bring you back to the table. And they think that you're not going to last more than a week. But when you get into that second week, what is the leverage that they're going to pick up the phone or email you and say, hey, come back to the table, let's talk, right? When you get to the second month, if this thing goes the way it should, you'll have that leverage, and the workers are the ones going to – that's why I keep telling people, yeah, you can have some smart negotiators. You can have these people bargaining for you, blah, blah, blah. But if you're not willing in Chicago at this moment to go and put all these big things on the table and stay out for them, then you might as well, you're just wasting everybody's time.
Yeah.
Just go ahead and sign the concession. Everybody go back to work the next day. Because Lightfoot's not giving up these things at any point unless you disrupt the flow of the city.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
Yeah. You know, I used to hear from a mutual friend of ours, Bill, that grew up in a union mining family, that miners between contracts would immediately, as soon as they finally got a contract after, you know, struggle, they would immediately start stockpiling food.
Yeah.
Money,
okay. Yeah.
And exactly. Ammunition in their cases, because they needed it a lot of times down in the coal fields. But, you know, in the case of teachers, I mean, stockpile, you know, save your money and, you know, start preparing, I mean, between contracts for doing what you have to do to get a decent contract. And unfortunately, most people, you know, it's so difficult to do, even if you want to, basically people are just barely getting by the way it is, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that we have, and that's the worst part about this, because I study these movements and I look at it. And one of the things I always see in the stuff I study in Atlanta is that once the objective of the strike, of the objective of the movement becomes different, when it's moved away from something, then you're automatically fracturing your workers because they're out on the lines every day thinking, this is what I get if I stay out here. This is what I get if I stay out here.
Yep.
And Whoa. Then this next press conference comes or this next public statement comes where the union leadership says, this is what we decided on. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. One of my favorite examples is this place we used in Southwest Atlanta called East Lake Meadows. And in the early 1970s, One of these great women organizers from the neighborhood named Ava Davis. And Ava Davis was this big time like community organizer. She did a lot of stuff at housing and whatnot. The problem was that there was this church's chicken that was right in the community in East Lake Meadows. And what they were doing is, as you know, there's not enough labor, especially for black women at the time, to get jobs. So Church's Chicken was farming out, getting labor from other places and having folks drive to the community. So you're trying to serve. So Ava Davis is like, you're serving us this food, but you're not putting back into our community doing all this stuff, and you're not paying your workers. And so what she did was she organized a neighborhood movement to push the strike, to push a strike in Church's Chicken.
Oh, wow.
So she actually got the workers in Church's Chicken from community pressure from East Lake Meadows neighborhood women to get these women in the Church's Chicken restaurant to walk off the job in a wildcat strike and saying that the only way that we will end this movement is if you start investing in our community, because Church's was a big franchise back then.
Oh, yeah. There was still one here in Champaign, Urbana. Yeah,
huge.
Yeah.
So you got to invest in our community and you got to hire in our community. The problem came later on after week three when they brought in this negotiator from the civil rights organizations.
Uh-huh.
And he comes in, yeah, and he says, I got this. I've negotiated contracts before. You know, I'm a big labor guy. I can help the workers with this. And Davis is like, but what about the community interest in this? Because this was bigger than just a simple union contract.
Mm-hmm.
And Williams is like, no, let me do my thing. And so Davis is like, all right, because he got a reputation now.
Mm-hmm. And this is the 70s.
Yeah, this is 72.
Okay.
Contract gets signed. Contract does a lot of great things for the workers who are hired at Church's Chicken. It gives them, it eliminates the tier structure. In other words, you don't, if you get hired there, you're not half-time anymore. You're full-time. I mean, you get benefits. Good stuff. The problem is later on in the contract, there's nothing for East Lake Meadows in it. In terms of you had to invest in the community. That's what Davis and the women wanted. The second part of it was that it was some stuff in there about black firms getting contracts for Church's Chicken. And we know what that means, getting contracts.
Mm-hmm.
That has nothing to do with the community itself. That was for these capitalists.
Yep.
Because black capitalism was emerging at that time to get contracts with the restaurant or the franchise, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened. So East Lake got completely cut out of their own movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what worries me when you look at the history behind CTU and their relationship to Lightfoot.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, at the beginning, if you followed this, they said at the beginning of this strike that it was that they were not playing for it to be long term. It was supposed to be short.
And then the members decided otherwise.
Yeah, the members like, nah, this is open ended. We going.
Yeah.
So that already lets you know that there's some odds between the rank and file and the leadership of CTU about the length of the strike and what they're willing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I am cautiously concerned about this strike.
I can understand. Also, you know, Rahm Emanuel was such a nasty piece of crap. I mean, he was easily hated, you know. I mean, God, it was difficult to like the guy unless you were some, you know, fat cat capitalist who was getting kickbacks from him, you know, for charter schools, whatever, you know. But Lightfoot, like you said, being the new, you know, African-American woman mayor, you know, that was supported by CTU. Oh,
yeah,
man.
She has some community support. She had community support, too.
Yeah, this is, I understand your concern.
Excuse me. I got a little update here on the Park District people I mentioned earlier.
In Chicago?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And apparently, I think it was on Wednesday, they reached an agreement, which is good for them, but it would have been kind of cool to have a big, you know, all these people striking and, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was like that for a minute.
In terms of, okay, but the details are, terms of the agreement with the SEIU included wage increases that range from 10% to 28% over the 4.5-year deal. So that would be 2.5% to
6.25%
per year.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. For the first time ever, the district will provide paid vacation to hourly employees based on the number of hours worked. In the presentations that's in the recording that I referred to on radioforall.net, they were talking there about how people, they just didn't have vacations at all, period. And that the first offer that the city gave was, okay, you can have something like 1 week after 7 years or some crazy thing. So they did well on that, apparently.
Okay.
In addition, Local 73 members have agreed to pay an additional 1.5% over the next 3 years towards their health care costs. Not good. Beginning in 2023, through these increases, employees will be collectively responsible for 15% of the Park District's total health care costs.
Whoa.
Which will be formulated as a percentage of salary.
Huh. Well, there goes that 6.2-something percent sounded decent. Now you throw that in there. It sounds like that they're going to be making less money.
And the Chicago Park District's other 24 unions have also agreed to health care contribution increases. And see, that's SEIU, you know, Local 73, and it's big. I think, are they here on campus?
Yeah,
they are.
Yeah, at the U of I, too.
Yeah.
So I thought they were.
So, okay, also, before we take a break, I want to mention in education labor news that the it was announced yesterday that the Champaign School District Support Staff Union and the Champaign School Board has come to a tentative agreement after bargaining since April, and the more details will come out. So we'll keep you posted on that. But it seems like education, you know, activity as far as strikes or negotiations are, you know, continuing all over the place. So take a quick music break, and then we'll be right back. So stay tuned. You listen to World Labor Alliance Supported Community Radio Station, WRFU, Radio Free Urbana. Okay. Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour, the supported community station, WRFU Radio Free Urbana. Some quick public service announcements. Next Saturday at 1 p.m. at the Illini Union is the State of Illinois Green Party Conference. Basically, the 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock session is going to be some speakers, including Kevin Zeiss, the spouse and partner of Dr. Margaret Flowers, who's called into the show a couple times over the last couple years. Kevin Zeiss and Dr. Margaret Flowers were recently arrested with a couple other people in defending the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., and they still have a legal battle fighting that out. But he's going to be talking about the importance of the need for a new coalition of anti-war movement to basically get to what we need in this country as far as Medicare for all, free post-high school education, that it's all tied in to all the money that's wasted, on military spending. So anyway, stay tuned after the World Labor Hour here on WRFU 104.5 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WRFU.net for another sports show with host fellow worker Neil Parr from 2 to 3, and from 3 to 4 is news from Neptune. And on Sunday, check out Labor's World View TV from 4 to 5 on Comcast Channel 6, live worldwide at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. This Sunday is part 2 of the 2003 film The Corporation. 150 years ago, the corporation was a relatively insignificant entity. Today, however, it is a vivid, dramatic, and pervasive presence in all of our lives, like the church, the monarchy, the communist party, and other times and places. The corporation is today's dominant institution. The corporation, the pathological pursuit of profit and power. The film is a timely, critical inquiry that invites CEOs, whistleblowers, brokers, gurus, spies, players, pawns, and pundits on a graphic, engaging quest to reveal the corporation's inner workings, curious history, controversial impacts, and possible futures. The corporation charts the spectacular rise of an institution aimed at achieving specific economic and political goals, as it also recounts victories against this apparently so-called invincible force. And a special shout-out to our friends Anthony and Joe at Shyampa Weed Radio at Shyampa.org. And again, thanks on the air to Anthony and Joe for being on the show, coming all the way from Tampa and Chicago last week to be on the show live.
Well, and also, too, I mentioned RadioForAll.net earlier, which is something that I really like, and that's where they get a lot of programming. Mm-hmm. And I'll do my darndest to upload that episode to RadioForAll.net. And speaking of internet kind of things, you might want to check out the WRFU website. Just type WRFU into your URL, whatever field, and you can find it. And you look at the page. And it's a fairly simple page. And one thing that's real prominent is the streaming, the Listen Now button. So you can stream it, which is a big deal. Tell your friends who live outside of Champaign, Urbana, mm-hmm. and have them start streaming public affairs off WRFU. Unfortunately, they cannot stream the music shows. Okay, another thing you can do is scroll on down the page until you hit to browse past shows, recording of some past shows. And that's a link that takes you to a page that has all of WRFU's public affairs programs, including the World Labor Hour.
Exactly.
And there's some really interesting stuff. And I'm going to start downloading more of that stuff to listen to also, especially the history show. I like the history show. I'm definitely going to get into that a lot more. Now we scroll back up and look to the upper right-hand corner of the page, and there's a big box that says Give Now. Might want to click that. Under that's Become a Member. Might want to click that. And there's also Share on Facebook and Twitter. Or Follow. Is that Share or Follow? Yes, it is. Oh, it's going to the Facebook page of the... Okay.
Yeah, just,
that's not a share, it's a follow.
So listeners know, the Independent Media Center was started in the year 2000, late 2000, and it was inspired by, basically about 12, 15 people from Champaign-Urbana went out to the WTO protests in Seattle in late 1999 and were very inspired, angered, or I guess inspired, to come back and start an independent indie media outlet. And
it's about the only thing Peter Miller talked about for a month.
Yeah.
Oh man, that is really it's really cool.
Indie medias were set up all over the country after the WTO protests, just because of the horrible corporate media coverage that was going on there. In fact, that was the first indie media, was actually the live non-corporate coverage that was done there in Seattle about what was really really going on, because the corporate media was totally distorting what was really happening there. So, yeah, so it goes, I mean, it's like, wow, 19 years now that the Independent Media Center has been here. So, you know, it's worth supporting. And I mean, it's a lot of good community events, music shows.
There was a big punk rock show last Friday.
Okay, yeah.
Here, so there's... And some bands I know played. This one band, Demolition Derby, they're from Lexington, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And they did a really, I saw them play at a party in B-Met, the Rock the F Out party in B-Met.
Okay.
And they did, one of the songs they did, they had these anti-Trump stickers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the songs they did was called Easter Island.
Oh, interesting.
Well,
okay.
You know what happened on Easter Island. This whole planet is now Easter Island.
I see the connection. Okay, I guess Gus and I are going to...
But I did want to say, there's not as much media made here as I would like.
Yeah.
There's the radio station, and there's the indie paper.
The Public Eye.
The Public Eye, yeah. Mm. Now, maybe when I retire, I may want to start getting some video happening here.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
You know, so I'd like you all to start clicking give now and become members so they can afford to buy video equipment in preparation for my retirement.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, Gus and I are going to kind of do a joint thing here, basically about stuff that's not being reported in corporate media about all sorts of demonstrations, riots, outright rebellions going on all throughout the Western Hemisphere and other parts of the world as well. And we've seen a lot of this, a huge uprising in Latin America that's been going on. Of course, you're not seeing any of this in the corporate media, but one of the hot spots has been Ecuador. I guess, when the... new president was elected a couple years ago, Lenin Moreno, who was the vice president of Rafael Correa.
Moreno, yay Correa.
Yeah, and basically who really turned lives around for the better for the Ecuadorian people. Well, when Rafael Correa couldn't run for a third term, when Lenin Moreno got elected, running on the policies of Rafael Correa, as soon as he got into office, he basically did a 180-degree turn and started making all sorts of austerity policies and deals with the IMF. So people finally, I guess there was going to be a fuel cost increase that was going to be, I mean, like double, triple of fuel prices. And I guess people took to the streets. They'd had enough.
Well, before Correa was elected, there was a lot of street taking in Ecuador for a few years.
Yes, in the early 2000s, indeed. The response from Moreno was to send out first the police, riot gear, and then when they couldn't handle it, he brought out the military, and there were several people killed, hundreds, injured, and it was like, finally, after, and it got so bad in the capital, Quito, that Moreno actually moved himself and his cabinet to the coastal city of Guayaquil, which is like 600 miles away.
Yeah, and that's sort of like the French Revolution. They moved to the aristocracy kind of, where did they move to?
I don't know. Yeah. So, yeah, so that and he finally backed down on the IMF. But the thing is that, the neoliberals are neoliberal, and even though he's had to back down, I'm sure this is not going to go away, and it's probably just a ceasefire, if you will, for now. In Bolivia,
wait a minute. Another thing Moreno did was he turned Julian Assange over.
Good point. Yeah, he basically turned Julian Assange over to the Brits, the Ecuadorian embassy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I guess this month, the deepening anti-capitalist movement in Bolivia is set to strengthen with the probable re-election of Evo Morales on October 20th.
Right.
Argentina is expected to remove right-wing president Marcia Marci on October 27th, to replace him with Alberto Fernandez. And so Morales in Bolivia has a 13-point lead at this point in the polls. He instituted a Medicare for all healthcare system in Bolivia last year. I mean, Bolivia is not as poor as Haiti and Honduras, but it's not far behind. And it's amazing that in such a country they was able to redirect and prioritize the resources of that country, the very limited resources, to actually have a national healthcare system. And
where I think the situation changed to make Evo Morales possible in Bolivia.
What's that?
Was several years ago they tried to privatize the water system.
Yes.
And people reacted.
Early 2000s.
Hugely.
Yes.
And I think that set it up for Morales.
Yeah.
And he's a very, very appealing person.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah, I'm surprised the U.S. hasn't gone after him at this point. I did see some trash articles in the BBC though about him. You know, kind of starting to till the soil.
Well,
you know?
They got wait till they take care of Venezuela. Then
yeah.
They'll go after
right.
him.
Right. But it's interesting. Argentina, I guess, under the right wing president Marcy, the economy has gone into crisis with poverty increasing.
Again.
Yeah. Again, increasing to a record 36.4%. A recession accompanied by a 40% inflation rate and an inflation rate of 25% during the first 7 months of this year. Argentina's unemployment is the highest level in 14 years. Poverty was at 19% that when the previous president Kirchner left office in 2015, Ferdinand's put forward an anti-hunger plan not dependent on the IMF. 3 weeks before the election, thousands of people rallied in Buenos Aires as the workers' left front sent a message of opposition to neoliberalism and austerity to the two major parties. And anyway, I guess... of course, everything going on in Honduras is still, you know, there. I guess in Honduras has been a revolt since the coup government of Juan Orlando Hernandez.
Maybe there'll be such a huge left backlash after the failure of capitalists in Argentina twice in a fairly short period of time. Maybe they'll go completely anarcho-syndicalist because the last crash got a lot of workers taking over the businesses.
And factories,
from absentee owners who pulled out.
Yep, that's right.
The famous ceramics factory and a hotel were the two that...
And there were a lot more, too. Yeah. The film, a Naomi Klein film, The Take, is a good documentation.
And we also had a friend that went down and filmed, but the footage was never edited.
Yeah, fortunately. Anyway, like in Central America, Honduras has been a revolt against the coup government of Orlando Hernando since it was put in place by Hillary Clinton in the Obama administration 10 years ago. And basically, neoliberalism, austerity, repression, and violence was the order of the day ever since then. Protests have been ongoing since this coup and fraud re-election a couple years ago. This summer, protests intensified with a national strike over austerity and privatization measures, trying to privatize their healthcare system and their public school system, which was a requirement for an IMF loan, and this led to a 66-day uprising, and the U.S. has trained Honduran police to use repressive measures in an attempt to stop protests, but their actions are merely feeding more protests.
Yeah. And they wonder why there's a whole bunch of Hondurans trying to get into the United States.
That leads into this next paragraph. Many in Honduras have fled to escape the corruption and violence in caravans. You know that's
created by the IMF.
Yep.
Yeah. Look. There's two revolutions that the IMF are starting now. Maybe I wish they'd start meddling in more countries.
Okay, that's a good point. So anyway, now a coalition of civil groups is urging the president's departure over a scandal ignited by accusations of large-scale drug trafficking to the United States being litigated against the president's brother, Juan Antonio Hernandez. In the trial set, several witnesses have declared, Antonio's campaign was financed with drug money and that he took millions in bribes from various Mexican drug lords, including the infamous Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. The Liberal Party joined in calling for his resignation. Protests have intensified. This trial may be the end of this cocaine-fueled presidency. Brazil's election of the right-wing Bolsonaro has been marred by scandal. Now the occupation of Operation Car Wash has been exposed.
Oh my God, that's almost as ridiculous. It's a lot worse, but it's almost as ridiculous and without foundation as Russiagate.
Oh, indeed. Private conversations between the prosecutors in Brazil and then Judge Sergio Moro, now Super Minister of Justice, show that former President Luiz Lula da Silva was the victim of a conspiracy to prevent him from running against Bolsonaro in the secret exchanges. Moro admitted that the corruption case was designed to frame him, and Lula has said that the United States was behind this conspiracy.
Well, and they framed Dilma, too.
Yep.
And, I mean, we'll see. You know what they're calling that now?
What?
Lawfare.
Yeah. That's right. I've seen that term. Yeah, the FBI, from what I understand, was very instrumental in setting up this sort of framing campaign, you know, using
really?
All their past tried and true techniques that they taught the Brazilians. Then Nicaragua survived a 2018 U.S. coup attempt, and the revolution continues to thrive after 40 years of independence from U.S. domination after U.S.-backed dictator Anastasio Somoza fled the country in 1979. And people were very confused about what was actually happening in Nicaragua in 2008 in the coup attempt, as various media, especially social media, misinformation was extremely prevalent. And then, of course, the ongoing thing with Venezuela. Trump has had to back off a little bit recently, but there's still a threat of war, possibly, you know, through the Organization of American States. And I guess they're prepared. Venezuela's prepared for a military attack and have created new alliances to overcome the U.S. economic threat of war. This week, Russia announced that it was investing $16.5 billion in Venezuela by the end of 2019.
I wish Russia had put troops in Venezuela.
Well,
I wish Russia and
they have.
China would. Real troops.
They have. Russia has provided anti-missile defense system and is keeping Navy ships in Venezuela to deter a U.S. blockade, and has helped gather intelligence on U.S. actions in the region. With their help, Venezuela has uncovered terrorist plots coming from Colombia and involving U.S. puppet Juan Guaido's team. Guaido has faltered and failed time and time again, and now is being investigated for ties to Colombian drug traffickers and corruption. So
we all know that it has ties to the Color Revolution movement. Was trained in, where was it, Croatia or something?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, sent to Eastern Europe to be trained by
Yes, and lastly here, in Puerto Rico, a colony of the United States, massive protests led to Governor Ricardo A. Rosello's meeting resigning on July 22nd. People also want the corrupt legislator cleaned out. The fiscal control board created by Obama ended, and the debt to be audited. Former political prisoner Luis Rosa said three things are needed: decolonization, into our colonial status through a constitutional assembly, health care free for all Puerto Rican citizens, and free public education up through the university level. And of course, now we come to Haiti, which I think Gus wants to report on some detail, because one thing I want to mention to start this is that what's really gone down the memory hole almost totally for people was the 2004 U.S. invasion and occupation of Haiti.
And kidnapping.
The kidnapping of their democratically elected president, Aristide, and his family, put on a U.S. military transport plane and literally dumped off in the Central African Republic.
Crazy.
Yeah. And people just totally, it's like, huh? What?
I mean, I don't know if it's that people are like, huh, what?
They just
it's
never
that
the, heard about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, mm-hmm. You got to understand, this is, I don't know why we, and not we in here, but we as in people in the Western Hemisphere want to continue to just ignore the fact that if it's black, people don't care, and they don't want to report, and they don't want you to care, and they don't want you to report on it. Like, that's what, again, we, even in the most devastating times in places like Haiti, you're not going to get any real coverage. I mean, let's be honest, when you think back to the tsunamis a few years ago, how much legitimate coverage was actually given to it in one of the most devastating periods in Haitian history? None. It's not there because they don't want you to care about it, because in their eyes you shouldn't.
How much do we know about Sub-Sahara Africa?
Absolutely.
And similarly.
Yeah. Exactly. Same thing.
You know, does anybody know who Paul? Probably about the same number of people who know who Richard Trumka is know who Paul Kagame is.
Probably less, really. Yeah. but that's a great comparison, though. And so, yeah, it's up to us and alternative media. And for those, a big shout out to Professor Pierre at the University of California, Los Angeles, who's done a lot of really good research on this. She actually has people on the ground reporting to her.
I saw
giving
her
some
in
stuff.
A really good interview. I can't remember if it was on RT or the Real News Network, but oh yeah, she's really good.
Yeah, she's on point. Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. You do have some academics who are fighting the neoliberal and the petty bourgeoisie turn in academia. They're still out there trying to put out the stories of the people struggling and fighting against capital. And so big shout out to her, because I read a lot of her stuff and she's really awesome. So what's happening right now in Haiti, for those, because like I said, they're not reporting on this anywhere. There are ongoing protests in Haiti right now that are directed at what the protesters are calling the core group. Mm-hmm. Which are the U.S.-backed forces that are destabilizing the entire country at this time. How is it happening?
Let me explain. So for 5 weeks now, the Haitian people have been engaged in anti-government protests that have shut down the entire country. Not just a couple of operations here or there, but the country is shut down because it's hundreds of thousands of people who are in the streets in the large one of the largest demonstrations in Haitian history. Makeshift roadblocks have been erected throughout the country. Schools are closed. Businesses are completely shuttered. Hospitals are barely managing, while agricultural goods from the countryside are unable to reach their markets. A situation acutely felt by Haiti's rural populations. Some 17 people have been shot and killed, by most accounts, by the Police Nationale d'Haïti. And more than 200 people have been reported injured. And again, these are just preliminary reports. Who knows what the actual numbers will be? A prominent journalist, Nahime Joseph, was assassinated when this thing started. The protests are not entirely new, as we've mentioned on this show. They are a continuation of the reaction to the Petrocaribe scandal and the profound corruption of the current government. However, framing these current protests and the ensuing political crisis only through poverty and corruption, which the liberals love to do because they say, look at those black people down there. They can't even govern themselves. They're corrupt. They're in crime and they're doing all this horrible stuff. That's what the liberals, both in journalism and in academia, are doing. This is utterly ridiculous because it is to forget the broad set of imperialists and capital that created the conditions for the protest. It is to perpetuate the easy narrative, this racialist identity politics garbage of Haiti and Haitians as inherently corrupt and violent, as being poverty stricken pathologically. It is also to condone the ongoing machinations of on Haiti, the workings of an international community bent on keeping Haiti on its knees. Because that's exactly how the U.S. makes a ton of its money, is by what Dave just reported. And what I'm talking about is crippling Latin America and exploiting every ounce of resource they can out of Latin America. The Petrocaribe initiative that has benefited Haiti since 2007 is the crucial element to this rebellion. Petrocaribe was a program established by the late Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez to provide discounted oil for a number of Caribbean nations in a way that would allow the money saved to be used by these nations for developing projects. When oil prices were high, which is at $100 per barrel, Venezuela provided oil to these nations where they only had to pay 60% up front and then allow 25-year delay in repaying the total bill at a 1% interest. It was a, quote, platform of energy cooperation, end quote, that was key to Venezuelan diplomacy in the region. Petrocaribe raised the ire of the U.S., as they always do, as it impacted the commercial interests of major oil corporations like Chevron and ExxonMobil. As WikiLeaks revealed, because WikiLeaks has been one of the greatest resources to showing how horrible U.S. government imperialism and capital is, WikiLeaks revealed that Haiti's participation was a constant point of contention for the U.S. relationship with former President René Préval and played a part in him losing the confidence of then Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. In 2017, investigators for the Haitian Senate revealed that almost $2 billion was diverted from Haiti's Petrocaribe fund and directed to private hands. A number of officials from the previous government of Michel Martelly were implicated. Jovenel Moise benefited directly. Benefited directly from the embezzling of funds, as Martelly used the funds to help him, Martinelli's protege, to come to power in 2017. In July 2018, there were protests when the government of President Jovenel Moise, following the dictates of the International Monetary Fund, which we already spoke about, attempted to remove all oil subsidies. No oil subsidies would mean up to a 50% increase in prices of gasoline products.
Moise was forced to suspend the unpopular measure. Haitian people took to the streets again in the fall of 2018, also not reported on by U.S. media, to protest the theft of the so-called Patrol Caribe funds. The protests were initiated on social media with hashtags, quote, Patrol Caribe Challenge and hashtag Coco Patrol Caribia, where the patrol, or in other words, it translated, where's the Patrol Caribe money? Mm-hmm. Question mark. From February 7th to 17th, 2019, also not reported by the U.S. media, massive protests marked the second anniversary of Moise's inauguration. Haitian people continue calling for his resignation. Many also viewed as treacherous the vote January 2019 by the Moise government in support of the U.S. to not recognize the legitimacy of President Nicolas Maduro. If anything, Moise's presidency is illegitimate. We can go back even further to the illegitimacy of Moise's selection to the presidency needs to be understood in the context of a long second occupation of Haiti, an occupation that comes after 1991 and 2004, U.S., France, and Canada-backed coup d'etats against the country's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The 2004 coup d'etat was followed by the establishment of a brutal multinational foreign military occupation with multiple variations and proxies. I'm not even going to attempt to read them all because it's millions of them. The designation of the core group, an unelected group of foreign powers headed by the U.S., as the arbiters of Haitian politics and economics, and the installation of the neo-Duvalierist regime under Michel Martelly and the selection of his handpicked successor. As Marlene Bastien of Family Action Network Movement recently told Nancy Pelosi in a public forum in Miami, quote, if there is a Jovenel Moise today, it's because there was a Michel Martelly who was handpicked by some of our friends, a reference to the Obama administration's installation of Martelly.
Yeah.
The second occupation of Haiti happened and is happening through four U.S. governments, both of them Republican and Democrat. Let me repeat, both of them Republican and Democrat, mostly Democrat. In other words, the current protests in Haiti have to be understood within the broader context of a renewed neo-colonialism, not a post-colonialism, but a neo-colonialism and imperialism that began in 2004, the 200th anniversary of Haiti's revolutionary independence. U.S. foreign policy towards Haiti has always been an imperial policy. Let me repeat that for those who do not understand how U.S. foreign policy works since going back to the Monroe Doctrine. U.S. foreign policy towards the Western Hemisphere, particularly Haiti, since the Monroe Doctrine, has always been an imperial policy. Journalist Kim Eves has rightly argued, quote, each electoral victory of the masses has been met by a coup d'etat and foreign military occupation until finally the empire changed tactics by fraudulently engineering the election of Martelly and Jovenel. Their regimes returned Haiti to a cozy relationship with Washington, end quote. Many of the protesters are also protesting against the core group with the message, quote, no more foreign military occupation, no more foreign meddling, stop supporting the Moise regime, end quote. In addition to picket signs calling for the president's resignation or calling the Haitian police criminals, there are others that declare kawoop or core group Haitians don't play. Donald Trump is a racist American. USA, France, Canada, no more coup d'etat. Enough is enough. Co-group or core group, among others. For their part, the young people have been protesting under the idea that Haiti not only needs the resignation of Moise, but also a full structural change, what they call a tabula rasa. After weeks of silence, Haiti's president finally addressed the people from the National Palace at the midday on October 15th. He announced that he would not resign, but blamed the corrupt political and economic system that he said would remain even if he did resign. Moise is correct that there is a broader system that needs to be dismantled. It is true that he is only a symptom of that system. Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
It also is the system that is keeping him in power, and he will remain in power until he is of no more use. In the meantime, the protests are continuing as we speak on this show right now, and that's what the U.S. media is refusing to tell you, is that their interference and imperialism in Haiti is causing a legitimate working-class rebellion in the space to stop the U.S. imperialism. It's looking almost like a neo-Haitian revolution,
yes,
because that's what happened in the original Haitian Revolution, where the U.S. and the British Empire and all these other empires tried to influence Haitian economics and politics, and they pushed them out and won their independence. It almost is feeling like that's happening right now in Haiti.
Yeah, I know. I've seen some video postings online, not from the media, of course, of some of these protests. Oh, man. I mean, there's some of these young people on motorcycles that are driving like right up to, towards the riot police and throwing Molotov cocktails, yep, one after the other. I mean, it's really intense.
Yeah, you break one window in Washington or San Francisco or Berkeley or somewhere, and it's like, oh, my God, it's a black, and they're violent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know. But, a couple of things. Wasn't Bill Clinton at one point called the unofficial viceroy of Haiti? I mean, because the Clintons had their hands so deep in the Haitian economic interest. That's the other thing. There's a lot of sweatshops in Haiti.
Yep.
And also, am I mistaken, Gus, aren't there a lot of mineral resources in
That's
Haiti?
That's right. There sure is.
And I mean, I remember there was gold and other stuff. And also that a few years, about 10 years ago, they discovered a fairly significant size oil reserve off the coast, of the South Coast.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and what really got me was that this occupation of Haiti, after the U.S. went in and first invaded, they went in and made sure they got everything pacified. The first thing they did, besides after they kidnapped the elected president and dumped him and his family in the Central African Republic, was ban the most popular political party in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And if you tried to have any rallies or activities with that political party, they would immediately jail you.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And the occupation that followed, because the U.S. kind of pulled mostly out, was by the United Nations.
That's right.
And I mean, the United Nations, I mean, was supposed to be the great, peacekeeper, arbitrary and stuff. But I think we started seeing cases in West Africa in the start in the late 90s about its non-objectivity, non-impartiality, and then Haiti really revealed it.
Yeah.
You know, that basically they have become the servants of international capital, you know.
Well, the United Nations is the fantastic example of the idea that people can't rule themselves, with the Security Council.
That's a good point, yeah.
You
know? That's a great point, yeah.
Yeah, because the Security Council, I mean, instead, the Security Council can overrule anything the General Assembly votes on.
Oh, yeah, the General Assembly has all kinds of really cool stuff that they vote on.
Yeah.
You know, and things, and then it just, doesn't matter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, this is interesting, though, your analogy between what's going on now and possibly leading to another, Haitian revolution.
I mean, because that's what they're fighting. They're fighting legitimately against U.S. imperialism and their influence on what happens, because there's such a storied history that you got a lot of people who grew up during this stuff as kids, mm-hmm, who are now movement activists and saying, no, we have to frame this in a different means. This is not solely about them, about the austerity policies. No, this is about what's causing those austerity policies. And if we get rid of that cause, then the austerity policies will follow, mm-hmm, which is a radical understanding of your social conditions. That's a self-emancipatory moment. It's something that we have to have here at some point. And it's not, we got to stop fighting against this one law and against this one president or against this one person. And we got to fight against the things that are causing,
yes,
these people and these laws to be created, because that garbage will follow once we contextualize it from a radical perspective.
Mm-hmm. I remember shortly after the 2010 earthquake there, that was real devastating, how Bill Clinton and George Bush hand in hand went on television to raise
money.
That's
Daddy Bush.
That was George W. Bush.
I thought that was Daddy Bush too.
It was George W. because Obama was in 2010, remember?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, regardless, it was
Bush. It was Daddy Bush.
Okay, whatever. I won't argue the point, but nevertheless, raising all this money, encouraging all these kids to go out and, you know, put up tables in front of, you know, shopping malls and grocery stores. Yep. And then that money just like kind of poof, vanished. Very, very little of it got to the Haitian people. Yep. And let's not forget some of the Clintons and nefarious business dealings in Haiti. I think the most classic was when Bill Clinton tried to, well, basically got relief funds for Haiti to buy up all those FEMA trailers from Arkansas yep. that were notoriously used in Katrina and then rejected. And Haitian people started getting ill and everything, and they had to withdraw them. I mean, it's like unbelievable. Yep.
Darn it, Dave. I'm wrong again.
Okay.
There's a Clinton Haiti fund.
Uh-huh.
The 2010 earthquake.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton and George W. Bush.
Okay.
Okay, I do remember something about that time. He was really palling around with Dad.
They were. That's why I remember too. They were going on like tours
everybody's
together.
Everybody's making a big deal about him now, and HW. And
yeah.
Didn't say
maybe
about W.
When was the big tsunami in Sri Lanka? Was that like 2000? Hmm. Maybe a couple years prior. Maybe that's what you're thinking of.
Yeah, there was something where they were really palling around to make some money. But see, Dad Bush didn't even mention here so far on the Wikipedia page.
And from what I understand, the reason Aristide was taken out by the Bush administration and the U.S. 101st Airborne was the fact that he wanted to raise taxes on the wealthy, basically wealthy investors from all over the world who had numerous sweatshops and custom free zones and stuff. And he wanted to raise the minimum wage, I think, about around 20%.
That's exactly what it was.
And that was like,
that was it.
You're gone. You know, that's the same thing that happened to Zelaya in Honduras.
Yep. It makes baseballs cost too much.
Yeah.
Every time the people elect a popular progressive person in Haiti, they are immediately replaced with a regressive and corrupt person by the United States every single time.
Yeah. And of course, I remember growing up as a kid in the 60s about, you'd see it, filter into films and stuff about, the horrible, brutal, which it was, dictatorship of Papa Doc Duvalier, but never explained who put him in power to begin with
and
supported him.
There's something I want to get in real quick.
Okay.
Number one, the stupid situation I described on my job would not happen if we had an anarcho-syndicalist system where the university would come to the Building Trades Council and we would rationally run the job without worrying about who's making a profit and who's paying for what.
Good point, Bill.
Number two, I would like to thank the nefarious forces behind, and Corey Morningstar is right, and she is not condemnatory on Greta herself. But I want to thank the nefarious forces behind Greta Thunberg's recent activities for bringing this out and finally getting some recognition of this terrible crisis that we have, existential crisis.
Yes.
And now it's time for us, the true radicals, to take that and